From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Under a blazing Texas sun, President Bush turned up the heat today on a lukewarm economy with a high-profile economic forum in Waco, Texas. The president invited business leaders, workers, and government officials to the campus of Baylor University for roundtable discussions on how to get the stagnant U.S. economy back on track. Despite concerns, the president said things are moving in the right direction.
We have three quarters of recession, three quarters of negative growth. And now we've had three quarters of positive growth. So the trend is in the right direction, which is important for Americans to understand.
The White House called the televised forum a chance for the president to, quote, hear from folks across the country. Democrats called the affair a public relations powder puff. This hour, On Point convenes its own economic forum. Some of the brightest economists in the country, including Lawrence Kotlikoff and Nobel Prize winner Paul Samuelson, share their ideas for getting the nation out of its financial funk. We begin in Waco, Texas, with Mike Allen, who's covering the forum for The Washington Post. I asked him what the mood was coming out of the summit.
The White House staff is ecstatic because there's pictures all day on all the channels of the president focusing on the economy, even in the middle of his working vacation. This is the working part of the vacation at his nearby ranch. During these sessions, the president mostly took notes and offered some little folksy asides, asking people where they were from or making little jokes about Texas or the heat, but did not engage the people frequently in policy discussions. Many of the people were reading their remarks for the president, so it came off as having a rather scripted air.
And yet, he heard that things were not all well. Charles Schwab himself told the president, we read, that the economy is at a very fragile point. It was a carefully crafted guest list. Did President Bush hear from his chosen guests what he wanted to hear?
The president was anxious to show concern, to not just say that everything's fine. His staff is so conscious of the experience of his father, who was perceived it as being out of touch. So this was a day that was all about the president appearing to be in touch. And you make a good point about Charles Schwab, whose firm had just announced a big layoff in their nearby Austin office. So the president said at the end, he said, I can tell that we have some work to do. He's confident in the long run, but he acknowledged that the recovery is nowhere near where he hoped it would be or where it needs to be.
What have you been hearing from attendees beyond the scripted televised portion? What's your sense of the sentiment at the meeting?
Well, the guest list was described as diverse, and indeed there are a couple of union members. There are some working class people. We had been warned that there would be no vocal critics of the president. In fact, there were no critics of the president at all. The people were almost uniformly praising his policies and asking him for more. So you had a group of people who were very fond of the president's policies, but some of them who are having struggles in their real life, and this was a chance for them to articulate their struggles, for the president to soak them in. One White House official told me, if the president hears even one thing today that he would not have thought of otherwise, then the whole forum is worthwhile.
They gathered more than 200 people for the president to have the chance to hear one thing he wouldn't have heard otherwise. What was the tenor of comments that you heard off camera, Mike?
Yeah, 240 people, 350 reporters, 400 phone lines. It's the world's most elaborate suggestion box. Off camera, people are saying that they appreciate the president showing concern, listening to them. What you hear Democrats saying is that this is a taxpayer-paid infomercial, that the president is not addressing hard issues such as his own tax cuts effect on the deficit. The one concrete step that he took today, as your listeners know, was he refused some $5 billion in spending that Congress had put into an anti-terrorism bill that he didn't consider most of it related directly to anti-terrorism. He says overspending is going to hurt the economy. So that was one thing he could point to, a sort of signal of his determination to take this on.
It was impossible to miss today the echo of Bill Clinton's economic forum. But I guess that they were run rather differently. Clinton sat at the head of the table and more or less emceed his event. President Bush and Vice President Cheney strolled through the seminars. Is that right? What was the atmosphere?
Well, you paint a great picture of it, and that's precisely right. Vice President Cheney didn't even pretend to interact with people. He began the sessions by saying, too often, Washington people just talk. I'm here to listen. The best policy will be for me to just listen to important things you have to say. And he did. The president did interact with the people. He did. It was funny, both the president and the vice president clearly had it in their mind that they were going to take notes. The president in big, bold letters with big underlined slashes through the page. The note-taking seemed to drop off as the morning went along.
Mike Allen, behind the theater of the meeting and the conversations going on there, what's your sense of the White House take on the economy right now? How worried are they?
Well, they are worried. I think there is agreement among the president's advisors that in the long run, things are going to be okay. They think toward the end of the year that things are going to be all right. Exactly the degree of it depends. This says, you know, this economic team is not known for its lockstep views. Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill predicting flatly that there will not be a recession. The president's chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors says that recession is unlikely, that things would really have to change. But they know that in the short term, they have problems with layoffs. They have people with watching their sort of the 401k effect of the shrinking retirements. They know that that presents a real and immediate problem.
Mike Allen, thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
Mike Allen is a reporter for The Washington Post who spoke to us from Waco, Texas. We're holding our own economic summit tonight right behind the hoedown in Waco. With Wall Street in the dumps, more than 8 million Americans on the unemployment lines, and midterm elections fast approaching, how do you think President Bush is handling the economy? Do you think the economy is on the mend, or is a double-dip recession around the corner? Are you still spending or hunkering down? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us tonight from Belmont, Massachusetts is Paul Samuelson. He won the 1970 Nobel Prize in Economics and is professor at MIT. Good evening. Welcome, and thank you so much for being with us, Paul Samuelson.
Hi, glad to be here.
It's great to have you. And from the studios of Vermont Public Radio, On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Professor Samuelson.
Hi there.
Paul Samuelson, please place us here. What is going on with this economy? Some days we wake up and think we're in a kind of world that's never existed before, with a confluence of a busted bubble and trust out the window, confidence lost in the corporate books, a recession, maybe a double recession, Wall Street. Frame this up for us. What is happening? Is this just a normal cycle, or is this something new?
Oh, okay. Let me remind us. The philosopher Hegel said, history repeats itself. The first time is tragedy, the second time is comedy.
Mm-hmm.
Today at Waco, we got the comedy. In the 1990s at Waco was the tragedy when the feds inadvertently killed the cult members who were holed up at their Alamo.
Burnt out David Koresh and crew.
Yeah. For an old-time economist like me, it was deja vu all over again, because in 1930, every time President Hoover made a speech to reassure the people, the Dow Index would lose another 7%. And in addition, make a mint for old Joe Kennedy, father of President Jack Kennedy.
And short seller.
Selling short Wall Street stocks short.
Mm-hmm.
This noon, I called up some trader acquaintances to find out whether the president's Waco was making them optimistic. They laughed at me as an out-of-touch economist. And at the close of the Bush powwow, we had the Dow down another 200 points. So none of what you asked me about, what is a rational appraisal of the pros and cons of whether we're going to go into a double dip, whether the Wall Street weakness is going to spread to the Main Street spending habits of the American people, was really touched on there. It was like a gathering of eight kindergarten sessions, and the principal goes from room to room, 15 minutes to each room, and gives his blessing.
It really was just from 9 to noon, 8 seminars simultaneously held with Bush and Cheney, each visiting 4. But Paul Samuelson, when an economist of your stature raises the Herbert Hoover name with us at a moment like this, it's going to raise fears in people's mind that maybe, in fact, that's what we're headed into.
Well, I'm not raising Herbert Hoover's name in order to, by innuendo, make you fearful that we're going to go into a Great Depression and 12,000 banks are going to fail this time, and a million homes are going to be foreclosed on, and several million bankruptcies to take place.
We're relieved.
What I'm speaking about is what the effect of mere soft soap words do, according to the economic history books, to the actual attitudes of the people on the firing line, namely the Main Street family population. And I don't know whether this will raise any contributions for the Republican Party, but this is not going to go down in the annals of economic history as a turning point where the country got a new belief in itself because of the eloquence of the president and the expertise as displayed there by his camp followers and the CEOs. But remember, there was a welder there, and there was a truck driver, so you might say it was a representative gathering.
Well, we know how such gatherings are made. Paul Samuelson, it's great to have you, and we want to dig much more into where this economy actually stands right now. But Jack Beatty, jump in with us here. Paul Samuelson is not giving President Bush much credit for the meeting today. When it was first announced, we all thought about, of course, the economic summit that Bill Clinton held some years ago, and it seemed that we had a Republican president following on with that kind of model.
Very different, though. The Clinton, I well remember, we were talking about this earlier, the Clinton seminar, that actually changed Clinton policy. Clinton ran on a Bob Reich idea of putting people first and stimulating the economy and, even at the point of a deficit. And I think some of the testimony he heard there really shifted his entire economic policy. He was open to it. He listened. And he got a lesson in, well, the connection between deficits and interest rates. Mm. And I think his whole economic policy began to change right there just days after the election. And it was because he was asking questions. He was involved. It was an extraordinary display. I don't know what Professor Samuelson thought of that, but
well,
I thought it was tremendous.
I agree. And even more in point, President Ford in the 1970s, early 74, when the country seemed to be going into a recession, held a summit. And if you're going to do those things, I don't believe a lot in them. The way that Ford did it was a lot better. He had Alan Greenspan, chairman of his Council of Economic Advisors, listen to 40 representative experts from both political party persuasions and business economists. And although Alan Greenspan and Arthur Burns were still wearing win buttons, whip inflation, of the 40 experts, something like 37 say, hey, the wind has been changing, and what you've got to think of now is to do something about the recession in being and which is getting worse.
Paul Samuelson, what do you wish President Bush had heard today, or what would you most like him to be hearing?
Well, first, I'd like to have the chief executive and staff listening to somebody and listening to some people who are informed about macroeconomics. That was what was being discussed. Now, the purpose, I believe, I understand, is to show that this president is concerned in a way that some people think, perhaps unfairly, that his father wasn't after the Gulf War when the country went into recession. And as a result, his father was refused a second term. I think President Bush would not like to have that happen. But if you like, we could turn away from PR to what are the important imponderables that are hanging over the economy.
Paul Samuelson, that's exactly what we want to talk about. Forgive me, we've got to take a short break here. We are delighted to be talking with Nobel Prize-winning economist Paul Samuelson tonight. Within our own little economic summit on the troubled U.S. economy, you can join us. What's your level of consumer confidence? What's your view of where the economy is headed? We are at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Here's President George Bush today in Waco, Texas.
We got the highest productivity in the world. We got the best farmers and ranchers in the world. We got the best manufacturers in the world. We got the hardest working people in the world. We got the best tax policy in the world. I mean, we got a lot going for us.
And we've got the hottest presidential Texas twang in a few months there. President Bush is on vacation, but today was a work day, the morning anyway, at an economic summit in Waco, Texas, with 250 people of all stripes, letting the president and vice president take notes on the U.S. economy. What do you think is working in this economy and what's not? Is the Bush administration's handling of the U.S. economy impressing you? Have you been laid off? What's it like out there looking for a job? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We are privileged tonight to be talking with Paul Samuelson, Nobel Prize winner in economics and professor of economics at MIT. And we're joined now as well by Larry Kotlikoff, chair of the economics department at Boston University. Good evening and welcome, Lawrence Kotlikoff. Very good to have you with us.
Thanks. Nice to be with you all.
Paul Samuelson just raised the big issue, just opened the curtains on the imponderables facing Americans and the U.S. economy right now, and we're going to get his view on that, but let us get your voice in here. What do you see as the table set before the president now and all Americans as they look at the U.S. economy? What are the big challenges that are sitting right in front of us?
Well, obviously, the economy is quite fragile, and whether we're going to go into another recession or just grow out of this is the million-dollar question, or billion, trillion-dollar question. The reality is that the president and the head of the Federal Reserve have done, you know, what most macroeconomists would have suggested that be done, namely cut interest rates, increase federal spending, cut taxes. So all those things have actually been done, and they were done in a pretty timely manner. So I would say that the actual conduct of macro policy has been very good in general. But I think that my major concern with what's going on with the administration is that they don't seem to be able to kind of galvanize the country to point them or to really convince them that the economy is going to move ahead and the country's going to move ahead. They seem to kind of say on the one hand, on the other hand, you know, they talk about how bad things are, but they think. But then the president says he's incredibly optimistic. But he's not giving us any real basis for that incredible optimism. He should really be pointing to particular sectors that are doing well. He should be pointing to the fact that despite these enormous shocks that the economy has suffered, we actually had a very mild temporary recession for two quarters and that the economy grew quite well in the previous quarter. This quarter, the growth is still positive, and that it's just amazing the economy is doing so well, given what it's experienced, but that we have, you know, the ability to coordinate our beliefs here and move forward. So I think that, you know, I agree with Paul Samuelson that what happened today was rather disappointing because it wasn't a very serious discussion, and you know, it just didn't raise the level of the debate here really convince anybody that there was more than a pep rally going on.
Paul Samuelson, how about it? Do you agree that the Bush administration's macro policy has been as good as Lawrence Kotlikoff suggests? And for that matter, can any president talk the economy into better performance?
Well, your second question is quite different from the first part of your question. Mm-hmm. And the answer is that very rarely can mere talk change for any period of time more fundamental forces. Now, I will not deny that at the bottom of the Great Depression, when the new President Roosevelt came in and said, we have nothing to fear but fear itself, that had a short-run influence. But what the New Deal did to get us out of the Depression was not to have Franklin Roosevelt make more speeches of that same kind. It spent billions and billions of dollars at a time when business investment was on its back, when risk aversion was at its maximum. Mm-hmm. And so you have to be doing things. So let me, if I may, give you a snapshot of what I think caused there to be this problem since the first quarter of the new millennium, since March of 2000.
We will listen with wide open ears.
Well, in a nutshell, we did have a bubble in Wall Street, a big bubble. It's not the biggest ever, but it's bigger than the 1929 bubble in my documented view. It's not as big as the two Japanese bubbles, but there's very cold comfort in that. The two Japanese bubbles were both a real estate bubble superimposed on a stock market bubble where price-earnings ratios were 200 to 1 in the Tokyo market and where you could buy three American skyscrapers for the cost of one Tokyo skyscraper.
And left Tokyo down in the dumps for more than a decade now.
Exactly. But here Herbert Hoover comes back into the picture because the paralysis of behavior in the law school-trained bureaucracy in Japan was only matched by the ignorance of the factions in the Diet and the ignorance of the cabinet officers in Japan. And so what started out as an important bubble, which was going to depress the economy for a year or two, they enabled it to snowball into a 12-year recession.
But so now, what is our fate post the 90s American bubble?
Okay, well, now let's go to this, into that. History teaches us that bubbles do reoccur with some unpredictable frequency. Mm-hmm. How long they last is not a subject we have a good handle on in econometrics or in history. But there is a tendency for a big up bubble to be followed by a serious down bubble. And when I talk about a serious down bubble, I'm not just talking about psychology, that everybody gets pessimistic and then that makes things go down and then they get more pessimistic. Mm. There was a great deal of distorted overinvestment in the high-tech areas and, in fact, in the manufacturing areas generally, so that my old-fashioned notes in business cycles courses in MIT, which I never thought to be relevant again, of overinvestment in one period causing a drag on the profitability of the redundant investments to give you a problem which monetary policy has a little trouble in successfully grappling with. Now, I have to tell you, I am not Professor Milton Friedman of the University of Chicago. And I don't believe that the Federal Reserve has a magic wand and can control the money supply when you get into, as Japan is in, a liquidity trap.
Are we headed into a down bubble? Are we headed into a liquidity trap? What should Americans be imagining?
We are in a down bubble. We are not in a liquidity trap, but we've had 11 reductions in the short-term interest rate. We are now at 1.75% short-term rate. The distance between 1.75% and zero is a lot smaller than the difference between the 5% and 6% that we had before Dr. Greenspan so presciently reduced interest rates.
He doesn't have a lot more lever to pull there.
In other words, some of our powder has been expended. Most traders did not expect that today the Federal Reserve would lower interest rates again.
And they didn't.
They expected exactly what happened, that they would not act, but they would say that the outlook has shifted from neutral to upward to neutral to downward. Mm. And that, in some sense, is reassuring to the trader mentality in the market. But I want to now go specifically to Bush White House actions. Superimposed on the down bubble has been an eruption of corporate misgovernance. And that is something which is not solely due to the new crew who came into office.
A legacy of the 90s, you're saying.
This is a trend ever since the first Reagan years of the 1980s.
Okay.
The new head of the SEC, that's Harvey Pitts, mm-hmm. who's now talking tough about corporate misgovernance, came into office having a record, and this is why he was appointed, I presume, of having been lawyer for all five of the big accounting firms.
Mm-hmm.
And his first statement was, I'm going to run a gentler and kinder SEC. Now, that's what I'm calling to our attention.
And that means this, gentler and kinder on the corporations. Jack Beattie, I want to bring you in here with Paul Samuelson.
Yes. There
is, despite the president's words intended to be comforting, despite a kind of native optimism in Americans that things should turn around, that there is still this fear that there could be a bigger pit out in front of us than we've yet dared to imagine.
Well, the parallels that Professor Samuelson was just invoking, the Japanese experience with a bubble, is something to ponder on. Admittedly, conditions are very different, but and what he said about distorted overinvestment, I'm not entirely sure I understand what it means. But are you saying, Professor, that essentially a lot of money went into places where it basically didn't produce anything?
Yeah, that's exactly. We had burn-up rates in the new technology field so that juniors at Yale could set up shop and get rid of a couple $1 billion in investment. We used to, in the Great Depression, call these Hayeks. These were buildings that got started and then couldn't be finished. Well, there's plenty of debris around, and there's also a lot of useful stuff around so that business enterprise in general is very well supplied with capital goods. You might say that in the years 1995 to the year 2000, we got a normal 7 or 8 years amount of capital formation. I only point this out because this makes it a little bit harder to use the ordinary tools of macroeconomics, mm-hmm. which Larry Kotsikoff properly enumerated. Federal Reserve monetary policy, that means interest rate policy, plus, if necessary, to go back to budgetary fiscal policy. I do want to mention one slightly cheerful element in the picture.
Bring it on.
Yeah. Thank Providence that we're not in a stagflation-like period where you have a lot of supply shocks, where OPEC prices mm-hmm. raised the price of oil fivefold, and you have, as in the 1970s, a rash of many failing harvests all over the world sending up prices. Because in that case, Greenspan and company mm-hmm. Would be in real dilemmas. They are also in dilemmas because, let's face it, the popularity of Greenspan, which was magnificent.
As high as it could be.
Was partly because he made money easy enough for stock markets to have this bubble.
Mm-hmm.
He talked about irrational exuberance. But then, and you can see it in the Federal Reserve speeches, he began himself to believe in the new economy. And my heart sank when I heard him say, people of probity are putting billions of dollars into these projects, that itself is kind of an indication of their worthwhileness.
It is. That word probity went a long way. Paul Samuelson, we have a lot of callers who want to join this who are grappling with this new economy that's not exactly the expected new economy. Please, let's let them in. Palmer's on the line. Welcome, Palmer. You're on the air.
Oh, hello. Greetings. Hi. I was listening to Professor Samuelson's remarks, and especially his comments about Japan are fascinating because I lived there from 1992 to 94, so I sort of saw what was going on there.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a completely sidereal remark. I actually called into your show about 10 months ago when you were all discussing about all the mass layoffs, what have you, and I was one of those people who was laid off. Well, I am still out of work. And
it's a long time, Palmer.
Oh, you bet. And all my friends and colleagues were all still out there, plugging away. Now, earlier in the discussion, did you mention there were 8 million people who had to work in this country?
Eight.
8 million, okay. Because I think I saw something in the New York Times today about a lower number, and you keep hearing all this boosterism about, you know, the economy's doing great, and, you know, we're going to do things, and it's going along. I think there were 6,000 jobs created in the month of July, according to, you know, the Federal Reserve Board or something like that. And, I mean, that to me it's a little bit terrifying when you have, like, you know, this dog and pony show down in Waco where you have, you know, the president telling us that, you know, good times are coming, and yet there are 8 million people out of work.
Palmer, have you been actively looking for work and it's just not there?
I've been looking for work in the Northeast, yes, for 10 months.
In what industry?
Well, I used to work in the aviation industry as an analyst, but that industry's been gutted. So, you know, you have to change careers and find a job. So I get to double whammy myself.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing I was fascinating about is, and I wanted to address, is that during all these conversations, the as I call it, the specter of Herbert Hoover keeps showing up, not only on, obviously, in this discussion tonight, but on in the print media, like in the newspapers and magazines I've been reading, and obviously I have a little more time on my hand. I'm in kind of an amateur study of economics. And, you know, most people say that Herbert Hoover was maligned as probably one of the worst presidents in the United States, or inherited the biggest bag of worms ever, you know?
Mm.
And so what's interesting is that, you know, I'm seeing, like, you know, myself, my colleagues, and we're sort of, you know, everyone's sort of getting by. And the other day, recently, I called my grandmother, who grew up during the Great Depression, and I asked her, well, I said, you know, is this what it's like? You know, is this what it was like? And she was, well, how do you mean? I said, well, think about it. Like, my sister's out of work, I'm out of work, everyone's sort of like, you know, stripping down, paring down. And she goes, well, yes, it was. I asked her, what did you do? She goes, well, you know, she said, told me her dad, like, lost a job, and actually it was in Texas, it was in Midland or Waco or something like that. And they were going to go down to Big Springs, and they had to, you know, they couldn't buy the house. And, you know, you let the cleaning lady go, or you keep the old car. And I'm seeing this here in the Northeast where, you know, we're all sort of doing the same thing, where everyone's getting by.
But Grandma was not exactly encouraging. Palmer, thank you for your call. Larry Kutlikoff, come in here.
Let me interject a little optimism.
Please.
I think that this conversation is heading a little bit, you know, in the wrong direction in terms of exactly the reality here. We have a very resilient economy.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact is, you know, we've had 9/11, the airline industry imploding, telecom imploding, Enron. And the economy still grew last quarter by 1.5%, and we still have a pretty low unemployment rate from a historical perspective. And we have, you know, if you look around, there's certain industries. Palmer's not in construction, but talk to people in construction in Massachusetts or in Vermont.
Mm-hmm.
It's booming, at least in the New England area, and retail seems to be holding up. My sense is the economy could get through this without anything major. We don't have the kind of financial banking problems that we had. You know, we don't have the possibility of a banking collapse like we had in the 30s because we have FDIC
mm-hmm.
insurance. We're not parallel to Japan in that sense because the Japanese banks are in bad shape.
So take heart, saying, Larry Kutlikoff.
Yeah, there's lots to look forward to. It's not all bad news.
We're glad for that. We're going to jump more into the U.S. economy. We're talking here in our own economic summit tonight. What do you think? What's your consumer confidence level now? Do we have anything more to fear than fear itself? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. President Bush held an economic summit earlier today in Waco, Texas. We're holding our own right now, but let's look back at a little more wisdom from President Bush.
I'm spending some time in Crawford, Texas. I think about how people in Crawford look at Wall Street and the numbers. And one of the things I hope that comes out of this discussion is how do we simplify the numbers so that people can understand what they're looking at.
We're trying to understand the economy and all we're looking at tonight. What's your view of where the economy is headed? What's working here and what's not? Is the Bush administration's handling of the economy impressing you? Are we just in a crisis of confidence here, or is there something more going on? We're joined tonight by Paul Samuelson, Nobel Prize-winning economist and professor of economics at MIT, by the chair of the Department of Economics at Boston University, Lawrence Kutlikoff, and right now by Dan Aronoff. He's the CEO and president of the Landon Companies in Bloomfield Hills, Michigan, joining us from Chicago. Good evening and welcome, Dan Aronoff.
Thank you. Good evening.
Thanks for being on. You wrote a letter to the editor today in the Financial Times. You said, talking about how you see the economy as a CEO and what you're looking for that might work and what you don't think is relevant at all. What are you most focused on right now as an American CEO looking at this economy?
Well, what I'm most focused on is the fact that the American economy appears to be suffering from a collapse in investment spending. And it seems to me that in the formulation of fiscal and monetary policy, the governments and the Federal Reserve ought to be looking at means at their disposal to provide incentives to increase investment spending, since that seems to be the area of the component of gross national product and expenditure that is dragging the economy down right now.
So you're not so worried about consumer spending. You want to see big dollars invested in industry.
Well, maybe you're not aware of it, but the new tax law has a 30%, I think, immediate expensing of equipment investment and also an acceleration of depreciation allowances. This may be something that that the government, the president, needs to really advertise, the fact that the new tax law is very favorable to new investment at the moment.
So, Larry Kutlikoff, you're saying that it's already in the works. Dan Aronoff, do you feel that? Are you aware of that?
I think that's a very good thing if it is.
Yeah, I think there's lots of provision in that tax law that people aren't aware of. I mean, I just actually learned about that aspect a few weeks ago myself. So this is the problem with it. This administration does not speak with a very strong voice and a very coordinated voice and a very coherent voice about the economy. And it, you know, we have the Treasury Secretary. God love him. He's a terrific guy and speaks his mind. But when he says to reporters, why should anybody listen to me? I'm surprised anybody listens to me. He makes these comments. Mm-hmm. We need somebody a little more forceful here to point out the positives that are going on and make it not sound just like PR.
Well, Larry, it's possible that you just became aware of this, but any financial officer worth his salt can read Lasser's monthly tax notes and have known this. It's something which in normal times would goose up investment spending in this time period when we need it at the expense of investment in a later time period. But right now, the lowness of interest rates does not mean that credit is easy. I don't want to go back to the Great Depression because, Larry, I agree with you. We drink the same Boston area water, apparently. The odds do not favor taking all the objective evidence into account that with even odds we're going to go into a double dip. Those odds of a double dip a few months ago were probably 2/10 that we would, 8/10 we won't. 8/10 is a lot bigger than 2/10.
And today?
Today, I would say it's more like 3/10, 4/10. I'm not using these numbers, this fuzzy arithmetic, to show my exactitude. I'm using them to show my inexactitude, that nobody can know the correct probability numbers. But the chance of a weak recovery, I think, is something we should be thinking about more than just whether we escape going into the National Bureau of Economic Research's definition of a relapse into another recession.
Dan Aronoff, if I may, the Nobel Prize winner is telling you it's more likely to be a weak recovery than a double dip. Are you prepared to operate your business on that presumption?
Well, I'm dealing with the business realities that I face on a daily basis, and quite frankly, one's forecast of the future doesn't really affect what I've got to do on a daily basis in my business, and I would certainly defer to Paul Samuelson's forecasting of the future than to any opinion that I have.
I have to quote from the great 19th century Concord transcendental philosopher, the woman who said, "I accept the universe." And Carlyle said,
"Margaret Fuller."
She'd damn well better accept it. And every businessman has to accept the realities. What Wall Street is probably not prepared for is they think that if we escape the double dip, we're back in the honeymoon days of profits going up 10-15% every year on the average, as did take place during the previous period. And I think if we just get our odds from looking at economic history, that after a very heavy period of investment with an overhang still here, and something like this did happen after the long prosperity period of the 1920s into the 1930s, then we could have a nice recovery, a 3% real rate of growth of GDP, which would mean that people who had lost their jobs in all probability will not get new jobs at 95% of their previous salary, but when they get down to 70% and the economy is not on the downside, Main Street will not be too bad. America will be a good neighbor to the exporters abroad. This does not necessarily justify a belief that Wall Street's about to go back to the previous happy days of 1995 to 2000.
So we don't have to come back like gangbusters to be all right. Dan Arnoff, thanks so much for joining us tonight. I want to turn to our callers. Brian is calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Welcome, Brian. You're on the air.
Hello, gentlemen. Nice to talk to you.
Good to have you.
It seems to me that, Shakespeare said, never a borrower nor lender be. And we were told... See, I'm confused by this because I've got a background in microeconomics.
Okay.
And kind of wimped out of macroeconomics in college. So I'm confused.
By the way, Shakespeare gave those lines to Polonius, I believe, and it's a bit of a parody.
And he was a very wise man. We were told in the 80s that, and the 90s, that we had a bubble. It was going to burst because everybody was borrowing money that they knew they couldn't pay back. Businesses that were making profits were still buying up other corporations with money that they didn't have. The government was spending like crazy money that they didn't have. And everybody was saying, don't do this. We're going to pull ourselves into a recession or a depression. And then 9/11 came, and the first thing out of George Bush's mouth was, let's all go buy something.
Yeah, I think you're on to something important here.
Larry Kutlikoff.
The long-run fiscal position of the country is really, really bad because we have 76 million baby boomers who are going to be retiring over the next 30 years. And what we've done is squandered the opportunity to really deal with that long-run crisis, fiscal crisis.
But it seems only a year or two ago we had the sense we were getting on top of that.
Well, remember, I think there was every president dropped the ball on this, and President Clinton has as much to be blamed for this as anybody else. I think he had a golden opportunity to really take this as a key issue and never really achieved it. So right now we're spending the Social Security surplus, if you believe it's a real surplus, and we're putting ourselves in a position where payroll taxes are likely to be doubled at the time that the baby boomers retire.
Jack Beatty, here we are again talking about Paul Samuelson has us getting into a recovery that may not be a booming recovery, but a decent recovery. And then Larry Kutlikoff reminds us we've got a real long-run fiscal problem here. Once again, we wonder what's going on.
Yeah, by the way, Larry, I don't know whether I'll live to see it, but I think that there's going to be a lot of reneging on the explicit and implicit promises
of Social Security
made to the to my six children who are baby boomers, because 2 + 2 still equals 4, and I don't see the 4 coming out after the real innovation in fiscal actions, which is the post 2001 massive 10-year reduction in taxes, which is very good for me and my affluent suburban neighbors, but isn't very good to that spot welder and truck driver who they tell me was at Waco today.
Larry Kutlikoff, I guess we have to ask you about that, the big tax cuts that go mainly to the wealthy. Do you see them as auguring well for the economy long term or not?
No, there was a study that was done a few months, about a year ago, by the Federal Reserve Bank of Cleveland and the Congressional Budget Office asking by how much, if you weren't going to cut Social Security benefits or any other kinds of benefits relative to what's projected, and if you weren't going to raise payroll taxes, by how much would you have to immediately and permanently raise federal income taxes? The answer that our government generated based on these long-term forecasts, which I think are optimistic to begin with, was a 63% tax hike. So
today, to keep Social Security solvent going forward,
all our programs, if we want to try and pay for everything we've got coming down the pike, we have to raise tax rates by a factor of 1.63 immediately and keep them higher forever.
But instead, we've cut them.
Cut them so that the Bush tax cut actually made our long-run problem about 20% worse. So I'm very concerned about the long run and have been for years, and I know Paul shares that concern. I think he's going to make it to see the problem, and we are going to renege, and I think we're going to start printing money like Argentina in the future to pay these bills. So I see a real severe long-run problem, but I see less of a less concern in the short run, to tell you the truth.
Jack Beatty, that long-run concern is the kind of thing, though, that can translate into people's perspective right now.
Yeah, we're all dead in the long run. Isn't that the I saw an article the other day with the title Rational Saturninity. That
Let's party.
Yeah, that the animal spirits that John Maynard Keynes talks about are now sort of in diminuendo. They account for rational exuberance, but they also account for a kind of, you know, cycle of bad feeling. And I'm just worried about the consumer. I mean, we've heard about the fall in investment spending, but gee, that consumer, how long can he keep it up? How long can he be expected to keep it up? His wages are falling, according to the New York Times. He's having to spend more money on his house than ever before. Real estate burden is very high. He's having to spend more money on his health care than before, and he will have to spend more. How long can he keep towing this thing on?
Paul Samuelson, how about that? President Bush has repeatedly asked Americans to get out and buy. Would that be your advice?
Well, that's meaningless. Baldwin, prime minister in Britain, went on the radio waves to do that. Professor Taussig at Harvard during the Great Depression went on the radio waves. There's no sign in the seismic instruments of macroeconomics that these imploring people to do that has any particular effect. It is true that if everybody had a spontaneous and permanent increase in animal spirits that would make them spend more, let's say in the year 1931, then the decade of the 1930s would have been a better one because we had poverty in the midst of plenty. We just weren't utilizing our resources. We really aren't there now. I agree with Larry that in the next 2 years, the odds are against our going deep into that situation again. But we have lots of problems, and I'm afraid that today I was looking, downloading the reports of the Waco meeting. The president praised self-policing by industry to members of an industry who had not been successful in policing them.
And that makes a long-term confidence problem. Paul Samuelson, we're out of time tonight. Would love to have you again. Thank you so much for being with us tonight. MIT professor and Nobel Prize winner Paul Samuelson, good night. And Lawrence Kotlikoff, chair of the Economics Department of Boston University, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Jack Beatty, thank you for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
And listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by